is provisional.
We all know that science has been among the toweringly successful achievements of our culture. But could it do better by being a bit more adventurous? By being less rigid in its attitudes? Open to ideas that are more maverick than methodical, more revolutionary than rigidly meticulous? Is innovation being stifled by our practicing safe science?
My problem with so much of the science establishment is there's a kind of Stalinist mentality of kind of central committees planning out research strategies and awarding grants, and an atmosphere of fear throughout the scientific community. People don't dare to step out of line.
That sinister Stalinist view of science comes from a true maverick, Rupert Sheldrake, who, for the most part, sits well beyond the fringe of orthodoxy. We'll be hearing more from him later, and you can judge for yourself whether he's prophet or victim. He raises, though, a concern that many share, that science is not the value-free pursuit of truth that it likes to claim for itself. It's uncomfortable with those individuals whose ideas seem counterintuitive, odd, even downright heretical or frightening. Now, it shouldn't matter whether the scientist is a lone outsider or a pillar of the establishment. But, says historian Simon Schaffer of Cambridge University, in reality, the individual does matter.
The official version of science tells us that it doesn't in the end matter who says something. What matters is whether it's true. It doesn't matter that the Cambridge professor of mathematics says that gravity varies as the inverse square. What matters is whether gravity varies as an inverse square law. But on the other hand, we know very well from the past of the sciences and from the way in which the sciences work now that you've got to convince expert colleagues in order for a theory or a claim or an observation to be taken seriously. So there's a potential contradiction there between it not mattering and it mattering a great deal who it is who's saying this.
So let's have a look in this program at some of those adventurous souls who came up with what seemed like wacky ideas, which ended up being taken into the bosom of the establishment, or not, as the case may be. It seems an odd place to start, but let me take you to a little scout hut on the outskirts of Reading, where special effects expert Nick Field is getting ready to demonstrate the legacy of one of science's genuine heroes.
First up, we arm the system, and to do that, flip this key switch here, and that spins up something called the spark gap inside, which is what makes the high frequency. Okay. So you might not want to be standing there.
Okay.
And now, we put the high voltage on it.
Nick's demonstrating a device that creates indoor lightning. A suitcase-sized transformer cranks up the local mains power to a beefy 700,000 volts. Within seconds, an ominous orange-blue spark twists and curls across the room into the familiar jagged lightning shape.
And lo and behold, a really spectacular little light effect, effectively lightning.
You did ask us to stand back. What would happen if I put my hand in the middle of that?
You'd probably be pretty well dead.
So how do people react to it when you first demonstrate it to them?
We had a thing in a haunted house a while back where the coil fired when they came round the corner. And at least two people just ran out screaming before it barely turned on.
Nick's lightning effects kit is in great demand from film directors, nightclub owners, and anyone else wanting to awe and impress their audience. Otherwise, it seems pretty useless. But it is, in fact, the brainchild of an extraordinary character called Nikola Tesla, a Croatian-born American who had a number of powerful ideas long before his time. Unfortunately, Tesla's personality wasn't remotely as electrifying as his famous spark-making coil.
He wasn't an endearing person. He's an eccentric. He just did not know how to relate to people, so he was seen as a real lone nutter.
Robert Lomas, the biographer of Tesla, a late 19th, early 20th century scientist, teeming with groundbreaking ideas and inventions, who's virtually unheard of today. In his lifetime, Tesla was on the receiving end of both the highest praise and extreme derision for coming up with notions that were to transform our lives, radio being one, along with all kinds of domestic electrical devices, and even that sci-fi standby, the death ray.
Most of the things he predicted came true. He actually forecast a communication system which, if you read the specification for it, reads like the internet. And he never got to build it. He actually got as far as building the tower for it, which he built just out to the north of New York. But it was never commissioned. And the aim was, he was not only going to transmit broadcast radio, communication channels, and lots of separate, secure communication channels, he was also planning to broadcast free power. And he sold these patents to a banker called J.P. Morgan, who then suppressed them, because J.P. Morgan ran the General Electric Company.
So Tesla was, for all his maverick genius, outmaneuvered and frustrated by the forces of big business and the establishment. And in his misfortunes, we can see perhaps the paradox of scientific advance. Science is supposed to proceed painstakingly through the collective efforts of dedicated researchers, slowly and carefully chiseling away to produce the monumental theories that push the whole enterprise to its next phase. There's intellectual safety in numbers. The established way of doing things ensures that all the right methodological checks and balances are kept in place. It's a good way of screening out chancers and charlatans. But what if an inspired individual comes up with a radically new idea, a revolutionary concept that simply doesn't fit with establishment orthodoxy? What happens then to the reasoned, moderate, and relatively slow progress of science?
It's very often the case that when a novel proposal is put forward within the scientific community, it's an extremely good idea to go back over the past of the sciences and try and find someone or a group of people who thought roughly the same thing but were then ignored or rejected. For reasons which I think are very interesting, the idea of the visionary heretic very often plays an extremely important role in scientific controversies now.
In other words, finding history's visionaries who were so far ahead of the game helps today's researchers to legitimize their work. And the further back in time you go, the more adventurous, the more prescient those visionaries seem, even though they may have had precious little evidence, if any at all, for their futuristic dreams.
There are people who've had ideas that have turned out in the very long run to be correct, and they haven't always put up a good case. Copernicus is a very good case in point. He comes up with his theory. It is not quite clear why he believed in it. He obviously put a lot of work into it. He does not make out a very strong case for believing that it is physically true.
Professor Judith Field of Birkbeck College, who specialises in science of the Renaissance, including the work of the 15th and 16th century Polish astronomer Copernicus, who came up with the revolutionary notion that the Sun is at the centre of our planetary system. It was an astonishing idea, completely at odds with the prevailing orthodoxy, but it came, in more ways than one, out of the blue. The Copernican theory was little more than an inspired guess. But because it had the merit of being right, its begetter isn't thought of as a crank.
Clearly, imagination is part of it. Imagination plays a huge part in science. You have to have an imaginative grasp of what is going on. But I think the difference between what passes for a scientist with hindsight and what passes for a crank is the amount of hard work they're prepared to put into understanding the mechanisms and coming up with a proper explanation. If you called a visionary somebody who believes in something for which they have some evidence that not everyone would accept at the time, but which they believe provides a basis for a life's hard work, and it's the hard work that makes the science, then my nominee would be Johannes Kepler, who believed that Copernicus, in saying that the Sun was at rest in the centre of the universe and the planetary system was centred on the Sun, he believed Copernicus's theory to such an extent that he spent the rest of his life trying to prove it was true.
The German Kepler, born in 1571, nearly 30 years after Copernicus's death, proved that the planets did indeed move around the Sun, but in squashed elliptical orbits, not the regular circles his predecessor postulated. Kepler was an extraordinarily hard worker, an assiduous analyst of data, precise and methodical, more like the familiar image of the painstaking scientist. But what if he'd been wrong? Who would have known at the time? Simon Schaffer again.
I don't think there's an algorithm or a little book of rules you can look up to say this new proposal is something we should take seriously, or this new proposal is the idea of some lunatic whom we should not take seriously. I think there's an enormous amount of improvisation and local judgment.
And one outstanding example of scientists getting it wrong, of mistaking a good theory for a bad one, was in the early years of the 20th century, when they poured wrath and scorn on the head of one Alfred Wegener. He noticed that if you cut up a map of the world and move all the land masses together, they seemed to fit beautifully like a jigsaw. The stark implication was that the continents had started off together, but had somehow drifted apart. How they'd managed this, Wegener didn't know, but he did come up with some geological and fossil evidence to support his theory of continental drift. The trouble was, Wegener wasn't an earth scientist, but a meteorologist. A crank, perhaps.
He wasn't a professional geologist. And, in fact, when he publishes edition after edition of his book on continental drift, it's not that the theory was accepted, but it was certainly discussed. There was a great deal of controversy and debate. And for reasons which, in retrospect, do not look bad, the scientific community as a whole, and certainly the geological community as a whole, as it were, put theory on the back burner, if I'm allowed to use that expression.
The geological community was split by the new theory propounded in 1910. 50 years later, recalls John Wilson, then a young scientist who fervently believed in Wegener's ideas, it was still divided.
Those ideas were tremendously exciting, but there was a lot of opposition, particularly from geophysicists who could not conceive of a mechanism that could bring all these things to pass. And after I graduated in 1960, I went to California Institute of Technology, and at one stage there was some discussion about continental drift, and I, of course, expressed my total commitment to the idea and was very enthusiastic about it. And I was met with a wall of skepticism. And this came as a bit of a surprise. And I sort of said, but why? Why do you not accept it? And they said, well, there's no mechanism. And me, being very confident in the idea that it had happened and was a fact, said to one of these very distinguished geophysicists, well, it's up to people like you to come up with the mechanism.
Which is exactly what happened. Evidence for a mechanism to drive the Earth's continental plates was slowly uncovered by later generations of scientists. Wegener's theory started to enjoy star status.
After Wegener's tragic and heroic death in Greenland on a polar expedition, and of course heretics have to die heroically, it all fits the model rather well. Well after that, different kinds of researchers found Wegener a useful person to revive. An example would be the great British physicist Patrick Blackett, who in the 1940s and 50s began working from London on geomagnetism. He deduced that the position of the pole seemed to have floated, seemed to have moved. His research group went back and found Wegener's drift theory a useful resource because it made their work now count.
Which was good news for Wegener's theory, but what of those individuals who stuck their necks out and were spectacularly wrong?
These are the people that we tend to forget about, and yet the qualities that they have that drove them to pursue some of these theories or inventions are not necessarily all that different than the ones that the successes had. For every tremendous discovery that someone makes, you have to follow lots and lots of false leads first.
Paul Collins, writer and connoisseur of failed scientific theories and their creators. One of his favorites is John Symes.
He's a guy that came out of the army as sort of a hero of the War of 1812 in the U.S. and decided that he was going to undertake the study of a field that he really had no training in whatsoever, and spent a tremendous amount of time learning about geology, about climate, about planetary formation, or what was known of it at the time, and then basically staked his reputation on a theory that nobody gave any credit to, nobody in the scientific community.
I declare that the earth is hollow and habitable within. Inquire of the botanist, and he will tell you that the plants which spring up spontaneously, agreeable to the established laws of nature, are hollow cylinders. Inquire of the anatomist, and he will tell you that the large bones of all animals are hollow. Even the minutest hairs of our heads are hollow. Go to the mineralist, and he will inform you that the stone called aerolites and many other mineral bodies are composed of hollow, concentric circles.
Despite his lack of formal geological training, he spent his life lecturing about his crackpot theory across the United States and tickling the imagination of a certain French novelist, Jules Verne.
This here, this is what is most fascinating. A little piece of parchment with strange writing on it.
Descend into the crater of Snæfellsjökull, and you will reach the center of the earth.
My boy, I've been waiting for something like this all my life. It is my destiny and yours.
You can't be serious.
We shall go to Iceland, and from there we shall journey to the center of the earth.
But what you suggest, it's against all the laws of science.
No, it's not. The fiery core theory is just that.
A theory?
Have all these bone-headed scientists who profess this theory been to see? Nine. We shall go and see for ourselves.
He had gone to Congress repeatedly, trying to get funding for a polar expedition, and it was given some consideration by Congress. I mean, that said, the congressmen were not necessarily very scientifically literate, and probably open to any number of crackpot theories, at least a certain number of the congressmen would be. But yeah, eventually there was a polar expedition by a follower of Symes. They actually went towards the South Pole, towards Antarctica, and found it quite impassable. And I think at that point decided that they had seen enough. The crew mutinied.
What then is Symes and the visionary Wegener? Both men were hardworking, believed they had good evidence for their ideas, and took enormous pains to convince others. What is it that makes a true innovator?
You certainly have to be willing to set aside societal norms for a moment. Or at the very least, you have to be ready to not accept the status quo in order to innovate. Sort of by definition, you have to want to change it if you're going to be innovative. And that's probably a tendency that a lot of people who would be considered eccentric have, is they don't necessarily feel bound by the strictures of how things are normally done.
So are we missing any unconsidered geniuses today because they're slipping like coins under the sofa cushion of history? Or is the very culture of modern science hostile to the revolutionary or unconventional visionary? Rupert Sheldrake thinks it is.
I think that there's a field, which I call a morphic field, in each kind of self-organizing thing, be it a crystal, a cell, an organism, a social group like a flock of birds. And this field has a kind of memory. It's organized by a memory from the past. And the so-called laws of nature are more like habits that evolve along with the universe, rather than being fixed laws laid down at the moment of the code.
Now, Sheldrake has raised many a hackle in the scientific establishment. He's undoubtedly an outsider. He started out conventionally enough, but then began to feel that something was missing from standard biology.
Even when I was an undergraduate, I began to find it was terribly limited, and it seemed to have a kind of tunnel vision. And the things I was interested in biology just didn't seem to get addressed. I've spent many years in conventional scientific institutions. I've always found, though, that there was a kind of narrowness of vision and a kind of fear about exploring anything that went beyond the narrow limits of what was permitted, which I've always found frustrating.
Anti-Sheldrake feeling reached its height when he was consigned to the ranks of the heretics on the publication of his first major book.
It was a serious book aimed at a scientific audience. And when the book came out, it was treated quite favorably by New Scientist. It was reviewed in all the main newspapers. People said this is a very interesting idea. And then there was this extraordinary attack in Nature. It was a front page editorial entitled A Book for Burning. I subscribed to Nature, I always have done, and when I got my copy of Nature and opened it, I was just amazed to see this title, A Book for Burning. I was even more amazed when I read the thing and found it was actually about my own book. I just couldn't believe it. But the attack was completely irrational. It was based on an extraordinary form of narrow dogmatism, almost a Stalinist idea.
Now, the merits or demerits of Sheldrake's science aren't really the issue here. What does deserve attention is the uneasy relationship between radical ideas that upset the establishment apple cart and the need to foster innovation and creativity.
In the 19th century, Darwin, for example, put forward radical ideas. He didn't have to deal with the science establishment because most science then was done by amateurs like him. He never had an academic post. He didn't have a government grant. He worked as an independent scientist from his country house in Kent. And he could say what he liked. Nowadays, there are very few scientists who have that independence. The younger ones are dependent on short-term contracts and on the patronage of their superiors, which makes them very frightened, very conservative, very afraid to step out of line. More senior scientists are dependent on a flow of grants and funds, which depends on yet higher up people in the science establishment approving their work and thinking they're good chaps and so on. And the effect of all this is to make people extraordinarily frightened of stepping out of line, and science in its ideology sees itself as doing a fearless exploration of the unknown. Most of the time it's a fearful exploration of the almost known.
Well, I'm pretty sure that few, if any of us, would bracket Rupert Sheldrake with Charles Darwin, but there are many scientists who are increasingly dissatisfied with the rigidity of modern research funding. The institutional mechanisms for developing novel ideas do look pretty conservative. So is there scope for some kind of beyond-the-fringe fund to give far-fetched, way-out concepts a chance to be tested properly? As it happens, such a fund does exist in the United States, where NASA has set up its Institute for Advanced Concepts, NIAC, run by Bob Casanova.
We're looking for really revolutionary ideas that reach well beyond what is being done now and even what is being thought of now. If you look back over revolutionary paradigm shifts in science and engineering, the genius has generally been in the generalities and not in the details. And of course, these ideas normally lead somewhere very special.
For example, to space by means of a very unusual kind of lift. NIAC's been inundated by proposals, some serious, some crackpot. Among the technologies Bob Casanova's considering are quantum communications, anti-gravity, and the space elevator.
The space elevator was better known for its science fiction. However, there's nothing wrong with the physics of the space elevator. What was needed for the space elevator are innovations in materials and various other aspects that would really make it work. The enabling technology for the space elevator wasn't available, and it still really isn't available now, but it looks like it's coming along. The enabling technology for the space elevator is carbon nanotube materials. They're a very strong, very lightweight. That will enable something like the space elevator.
We so the space elevator would be literally an elevator big enough to take you into space? I mean, it would be that
Yes. Oh, yes. It would reach from the Earth's surface near the equator out to about 60,000 miles.
Bob Casanova is a calm and serious man who thoroughly endorses the rigor and method of conventional science. But, like Rupert Sheldrake, he's concerned that the way science is managed and funded can let genuine innovations slip through the net.
You need to think somewhat out of the ordinary to make these things happen. We're trying to inspire different paradigms now.
It could be argued that, yeah, it's fine to look ahead like this, but you're basically bankrolling people who are upsetting the apple cart. They're scientific troublemakers. Sometimes they're pseudoscientists, indeed.
Well, I don't think we're funding any pseudoscientists. We have funded some innovators, but they're credible innovators. But they may be investigating things that I think in the normal conservative scientific fields might be on the fringe, but we want to open some doors to new thinking, and so sometimes we have to be on that fringe.
Bob Casanova is a conceptual matchmaker. He puts radical thinkers in touch with the expertise that will help realize their visions. And that, says Simon Schaffer, is crucial. We may like to fantasize over the impact of the lone genius, but science does not, cannot work that way.
Science is very, very hard work, and a lot of that work is work of persuasion, of enrollment, of recruiting, of finding allies, of showing that one's novel proposal fits in with, or reinforces, or adds to the significance of other folks' work. The lone wolf is a figure of enormous fascination but also great suspicion in the community of the sciences. And one reason for that in the end is because the sciences are so profoundly collective.
There's a wonderful scene in Graham Greene's The Third Man when Harry Lime is comparing Switzerland and Italy. Switzerland, he says, has enjoyed peace and tranquility for centuries, and all it's come up with, by way of innovation, is the cuckoo clock. Italy, on the other hand, has a violent history full of bloodshed and prejudice and conflict, but it gave the world the glories of Renaissance art and culture. Scientific innovation for Simon Schaffer is a bit like that. If you want to get anywhere, you have to arrange things, that's manage researchers and their funding, so that you deliberately put grit into the oyster. It's a messy business, creativity.
The sciences flourish in an atmosphere of controversy and dissent and struggle. I think that's very clear. And any institutional arrangements which foster open public debate and which recognize the plausibility of many different rival approaches to a problem is likely to be the most efficient way of cultivating scientific advance.
I think that science is stuck at the moment, stuck within a narrow, dogmatic and very limited system. I think it's bound to break out sooner or later. And I and people like me are trying to find ways in which it can move forward, in which we can explore areas at present off limits from institutional science.
Ahead of Their Time was presented by Peter Evans and produced by Jim Clark. Now, London faces its fastest period of growth since the industrial